We come to the fourth presentation after the first four, which were a precis of the 2012 year cycle of presentations. The title of the entire year is Hermetic Bodhisattvas. And as you saw, if you've gone through the prelude, those four presentations, we're looking at something that is rather serious. And that is that in nature, there's only one time dimension. And rather than the fourth dimension, it's the first dimension. And time is an energy and occurs spontaneously out of a zero field of nature. So that the charting of a frequency of energy will always have a symmetry of crests and troughs, but will have an invisible line which mediates the symmetry of crests and troughs, and that median line is zero. It does not register, but it allows spontaneously for a symmetrical registering of the peaks and the troughs, and that a cycle of this becomes then the recorded signature of the frequency of the energy. And that this occurs in pairs of peaks and troughs, spontaneously mediated by a zero horizon that has momentum because the symmetry keeps alternating. And out of this, instantly, not spontaneously, but instantly, so that time and space, which blossoms instantly out of it, have a characteristic which is notable. And the first person 2,500 years ago to analytically identify what this means was Pythagoras, and he pointed out that the universe is finite because it can be computed by number. You cannot compute an infinity by number, but you can compute a universe by number. And further, that the largest spectrum of number are ratios. Proportions, yes, but ratios. And that there's an index of ratios that one can not only analytically understand in terms of a mathematic, but one can produce it in terms of sound. That you can take a limited chord, a string, and you can cut it in half with a plectrum or a finger and have one half. And you can continue to do this with that string. You can have a half, you can have a third, you can have a fourth, a fifth, and all of these will be able to be heard in terms of musical notes. And Pythagoras took up to a tenth. Out of this came the mathematics of music and the ability then to understand that feeling tones can be evoked by music, just as feeling tones can be evoked by images. So that images and ratios have an interesting concurrence in terms of the way in which our experience is shaped, is given not only a shape, but a form which is capable of a double critical appreciation. One is the aesthetics of music, which also has an element of number and ratios, and an analytic, which also has, as a part of its ratioing, an aesthetic of understanding that the simplest is beautiful in terms of ratios and proportions. That 2,500 year ago, 500 BC, was a part of a very complex time form that is not in nature, but is in civilization. And that there was a prototype of this in human cultures that was affine to the cultures of animals. At least in terms of the West, it was in terms of animals, whereas in the East, it was in terms of plants. When one goes to the Chandogya Upanishad, plants are the essence of nature, man is the essence of plants, speech is the essence of man, Om is the essence of speech. And one gets this kind of declension that we belong to a nature which is indexed largely by plants, whereas in the West it's largely by animals. What is important for our understanding is that if there are complex time forms that began to emerge in culture, that the experience that we have that is mostly natural will have tend to try to have itself weave into a natural rhythm of time, a planting rhythm, but also a following of the animals' rhythm, hunters and gatherers. And that the health of a culture of basic en naturel experience is to fit into a natural cycle so that one begins to notice that the metronomes of a natural cycle are basically by the moon, the phases of the moon, the positions of the sun, the seasons that occur, what the animals are doing in that cycle, what the plants do in that cycle. And so a culture is mostly still in nature, but begins to refine itself so that it becomes proto-civilization, in which case it begins to have not a bifurcation of time, but a triadic division of time. So that when we get to full-blown civilizations, they become indexed by something that was radically a portal out of the natural space-time, and that was written language. And that one learned to read through pictographs, to read through hieroglyphics, to read through eventually what became alphabetical languages. And one read through to a different kind of time. That kind of time did not belong to the space-time of the universe, but it belonged to a different dimension other than the universe. It belonged to the context within which the universe's limitations occurred, both spontaneously and instantly, and eventually over time more complexly. And in the Greek language, there were two different words that were stressed and used, and the best study of this was done by a woman from the Catholic University in Milan, in Milano, and her name is Ilaria Ramelli, and her companion in doing this particular volume was David Constant, who's an American, The title of the book is Terms for Eternity, and on it you have a Mobius strip stylized artistically amid not stars, but if you look closely, these are sparks of energy. So that in eternity, energy is the first thing that sparks spontaneously into phenomenality, and those sparks, when they collect, when they have an integral sequencing, they become the electrons, the photons, the protons, the neutrons, they become the particles, but they also have that symmetry, that ambidextrousness, that the energy is capable of absorbing the particality, and that the eternity is capable of absorbing that energy, so that time disappears and then reappears. And when it does, instantly, particles both disappear and reappear. And 21st century physics is quite familiar with this. In fact, we've been familiar for a long time. We call it vibration. But the vibration that we think of in the West is the peaks and the troughs in their signature of that frequency, whereas in Asia, the recognition was always that that zero horizon is what makes the symmetry of the energy real. It does not make it objective. It does not make it phenomenal. Rather, it makes it real. She points out that two very close words in Greek, one is aionios and the other is aidios, A-I-D-O-S, Ramelli noted that in these passages, the adjective usually translated as eternal is invariably aionios. Aionios, a term, may sometimes mean eternal, but also bears many other meanings, whereas to indicate eternal life, Scripture also employs aidios, which always means eternal in the strict sense. She noticed that while studying the fathers, that is the later Christian and early Byzantine fathers, like Basil of Caesarea, so forth, Gregory of Nyssa, Oregon. While studying the fathers who supported the doctrine of apokatastasis, that there is a limit to the limit, beyond which one has entered into the real lucidity of the unlimited. Thus, whereas life and bliss are described as properly eternal, death and punishment are aionia, that is, pertaining as properly eternal and pertaining to the next aeon, but not necessarily strictly eternal. So that what comes out of this is in the East, the notion of karma, that whatever occurs objectively in a limited universe will have a result of that cause, and that causality continues until it exhausts not the space dimensions, but exhausts the time dimension. And that the only way to permanently deal with karma is to vanish it out of the universe into eternity. Now, this posed a huge problem 2,000 years ago. The problem was, it means then that any life form of any complexity whatsoever that lives in the universe is subject to karma. Not only subject to karma, but carries it with an increasing energy. It doesn't just remain, but it continues to build, or it can continue to weather down. It can go either way, but it tends, once it begins, either of those directions to increase, so that there are then civilizations in the universe that have gone a long way to hell. And have not only become demonic, but they have become evil. And what they seek to do then is to ensure that their karma is distributed to others. And the rationale behind this is in beautiful phrase, a couple of lines, in Christopher Marlowe's great play, Dr. Faustus. Faustus asks Mephistopheles, the emissary of the devil, why does he want our souls anyway? And Mephistopheles replies in Latin, and the translation is, misery loves company. Marlowe was a red-haired, vigorous, outlaw sort of a man, and died as a result of a bar fight, very young. Quite a genius, had an MA at the time from university, and was really somebody. The redistributing of the evil becomes then something that is like a contagion, and that any thing, any one who bucks that continues then to have the feed of not just the incident, but the streams behind the incident trying to keep redistributing it. And those streams are fed by huge rivers and finally by an ocean. So that one begins, if you try to work as an individual, you simply face an increasing burden until you are not crushed so much, until you are smushed into the evil. However, the good news is that when one penetrates to a higher dimension, evil has no traction whatsoever. Karma does not occur any longer. And not only does it not occur, but it evaporates without leaving a trace. The ancient way in which a great sage named Valmiki, who wrote the Ramayana, Valmiki's name means in Sanskrit, white ant hill. He could meditate long enough in his forest abode that the white ants could build their abode around him, and he never flinched, he never moved, didn't need to eat. And Valmiki discovered when he was in deep meditation in the forest that a hunter came in, and there was a particular wonderful bird that was singing, and the hunter took his bow and arrow and shot the bird and killed the bird. And immediately Valmiki, without coming out of his meditation, uttered something that evaporated the hunter into soot, and then that soot just was absorbed into a mist, and the mist disappeared. And he began to meditate on not what he had said, but the form of what he had said, was the beginnings of the poetic form called in Sanskrit a sloka. It's a double line. And the second line modifies and refines the first line and can take it into a crest or can take it into a trough. If it takes it into a trough, you need to understand that there's nowhere you can flee. If it goes into a crest, you have to understand there's everywhere that you're going to be welcome. And so the poetic of Valmiki became the basis of the great body of Sanskrit literature. But they used, as a model of poetic Sanskrit, an earlier language that had developed the original poetic of alphabetical written language. And that language was Avestan, which goes back to about 1925 BC, whereas the Rig Veda in Sanskrit goes into probably at the very earliest 1500 BC, more likely somewhere around 1300 BC. And Valmiki is about 1,000 years later. What's of interest to us is that we have emerged through a threshold in our lifetime that is immensely multiple times the frequency of all past aeons when they come into play. And when they come into play, they come into play, as we have been saying, because they have an anchor, like a reference wave, that sets the indexing tone, and then a carrier wave comes in that makes the scalar by which all expression then will be able to have an increased ability to express in higher dimensions. If you do rituals in nature, that develops into a cult of activities and things, whatever you do, and builds karma. And the whole purpose then is to have a constant refresher that handles those actions, that handles those things, in such a way that they optimize that the experience, which I call a mythic horizon, is enriching rather than cursing. So that constantly the rituals have to be tended to accurately, and in this case there have to be some men, some women, who understands how to keep retuning the rituals so that the experience, which will be indexed by an oral language that rolls on the images and breathes in the feelings, is able then to have a mythic folding back into nature, because by folding back into nature, the culture keeps the cult from skewing into the negative. And the key to it in a ritual is always reciprocity. Because if you receive and you give equally, that means that the karma is a karma which is for the community, not for the individual. But increasingly, if you keep the cycle in the integral, those in the symbolic, meaningful structuring will inevitably begin to skew towards an individuality which stops the cycle from being accurately refreshed. Because one doesn't go all the way back to nature, one goes back to the doctrinization of the integral increasingly, because those become then the experts, the power people. And one then has rituals that seek to keep an identification with the symbolic structure of the powerful. And that experience becomes more and more parenthetical between this identification and we call this tyranny. And it's been called that for a long time. There are no tyrannies on the tribal level, but civilization is cursed by tyrannies. And especially when one does not move into the new time form with the new referent wave, a recursion happens and one slips into the previous reference wave, 1,000 years before that. We have lived in a time where that is exactly what has happened on this planet to the species. Our reference wave was about 1650. It was the mathematization of language with Sir Isaac Newton and with Leibniz. Leibniz, who based himself on a translation into Latin of the I Ching by Jesuit missionaries out of China, and the great philosopher Spinoza in Amsterdam showed the young 20-year-old Leibniz, who was a mathematical genius, and he realized that what you're dealing with here with yin and yang, with the unbroken line and the broken line, you're dealing with ones and zeros, binary, and that they come packaged together as a bit. So Leibniz's terminology for calculus is the one that we use today. Newton was a little bit more sophisticated. He sensed that you cannot have a bit so much as you have to have something that has elasticity and it has flexibility, because there may be more to it than what you were able to identify. And so he called them fluxions, which was too difficult 300 some years ago to write out extensively and to think out. And so we used Leibniz's notation because it was more limited and therefore it was more computable. Newton, though, being really a great universal genius, realized there is something more here. And the key to it, because he was very brilliant, he said there is a ratio in the Bible that needs to be understood. What is the proportionate relationship of the book of Daniel to the apocalypse of St. John? That somehow the end of the New Testament and the last great turning point of the Old Testament must have some kind of a relationship, a ratioability. And he spent the last 30 years of his life trying to understand what that might be and never found it. However, the point which challenges us, which endangers us as a species, as a civilization, as a planetary life form, is that the previous anchor of the previous reference wave was 650 AD. And the pair were Muhammad and Tang Tai Tsung, the founder of the Tang Dynasty, the pinnacle of China, and the founder of Islam. And so we have a planet that has gone back to a large population, the Muslims and the Chinese, who are not at all interested in going into a Newtonian Leibniz reference wave, because that means then they're going to become more, quote, historical and not power people. They're going to have to become planetary. And not just planetary, but that mathematics, that calculus, it extends not only to the whole universe, but extends beyond the universe into higher dimensions. One likes to say, there is no victor but Allah, and this is so, but Allah may not be limited to the universe. The Chinese say the longest journey takes place with a single step, but the single step might be no movement at all, as the quote, step, as in Lao Tzu, the Tao that can be named is not the eternal name. One of the interesting things is that while the first reference wave of civilization was the development of written language, about 4350 BC, the first carrier wave, about 4000 BC, as we've been talking about, were the first men and women who were acclimated to living in a world perforated by written language portals that led out of the natural time form, out of the natural space, and they literally became challenged by being capable of something supernatural. And so Adam and Eve are not thrown out of Eden. They filter themselves out of the natural garden and begin to try to reconstruct it. And of course, there's always a triad. It's not only Cain and Abel, but also Seth. And it's interesting to see the interplay of that recounted by a reference wave about 1350 BC. 1350 BC is 2,000 years before Muhammad and Tang Tai Tsung. So it has an aeonic relationship, and that reference wave is Moses. Quite powerful. So that the reference wave of Islam and China, which are the result now of having power on this planet, with this species, on this world now, are still part of a slide because it's a regression, because that already happened. Revisiting that means one's going back, but there's no way to stop going back, and the next reference wave will be Alexander the Great, 350 BC, and after that will be Moses, and they're trying to co-opt both. There cannot be a single family oikumene, we call it ecumene in Latin. There cannot be a single family of man. You're not going to include disbelievers, those who do not cooperate with the dynasty. And then you cannot slip back, because then you find a Jewish reference wave like Moses. And so there's a huge motion to co-opt and not let there be anything to slide back to. But the fact is that is now karmic on a radioactive level. And the only way is to turn those rituals into a yoga. Because a yoga does not engender karma, it engenders a tapas. And that tapas always builds to not only health, but to eternal life. And by making a yoga out of learning, one slips into higher dimensions where the karma of itself is tractionless. And one of the qualities that occurs is that what one does then, there's a quality of effortlessness, not coasting. I wrote a science fiction novel about future native kids on the moon, and to get around on the dust, they jet ski. they can go 200 or 300 miles an hour because they're really ambidextrous. Let's take a break. Let's come back to our continuing the 2012 series, like that of 2011 and 2010, are emendations and meant to explore and enrich the major work that I put in some 42 years now, which is called The Learning Civilization, its last offering, complete 2006 and 2007, which is now going to be released in a highly creative way that my wife, Nisa, has designed a wonderful way through an app to express and communicate what I have a long time now called the yoga of civilization. There is a way to build tapas to evaporate karma on a rather large scale, large meaning it dwarfs industrial scale. It dwarfs empire scale. It creates a star system civilization. We have a huge, wonderful threshold coming in 2016. And we've talked about that several times, and not more today. We need to understand that our particular carrier wave focused its apex threshold in 1991, so that we live now in about the 21st year after. The reason for this is that the time form of the carrier wave was not 0 BC, but 9 BC, which means that, in fact, when one looks at the way in which cycles were computed 2,000 years ago by men and women who were quite alert to the change of ages, the new age then, that an epical date would have been 41 AD. From 9 BC to 41 AD is 50 years, it's a jubilee. And those men and women who were conscious prismatically then and alert to history then and capable of a very refined analytic then understood that one needs to count the natural cycle by an index of a conscious dimensional ecology, and that every 50 days, every jubilee, would have its harvest day, which would be the 50th day, and that when you looked at the annual year, 7 times 50 would give you 350 days, almost all of the annual cycle of the year, plus a 2-week, a fortnight of holiness to ensure that it wasn't just a series of jubilees, but that they were aired out by the Spirit. When one looks at 41 AD, as we have been showing, one finds the arms of the carrier wave stretched as far as they could stretch. They stretched from the Irish Sea to the Bay of Bengal, from the focus, which was in Alexandria. And when we get to it next week, we'll talk a little bit about the Irish Sea, those areas surrounding it, Ireland, southern Scotland, England, Wales, the West Country, all of that held a very great mystery that now we can begin to piece together and understand, and not just piece and understand, but to comb it so that it becomes a seamless fabric, a cloak without seams. And central to that is the way in which the Hermetic creature became the Holy Grail. And we'll talk more next week and the following weeks. This study is called The Crater and the Grail, Hermetic Sources of the Parseval. That the whole Arthurian ethos for now some 1,500 years has been involved with this, trying valiantly to understand, but in a way in which it remained a mystery, and one can live with a mystery, but one cannot deal with a mystery of mysteries. And so there are two ways in which those are traditionally dealt with. One of the ways is by pilgrimage, to try to use a pilgrimage to go to some sacred site and immerse oneself there, like the Hajj going to Mecca and the Kaaba, or for early Christians, one of the earliest sites, of course, was Bethlehem, but one of the longest pilgrimages was to the northwest of Spain, to Santiago del Compostela, St. James of the Stars, because that's where he went in 41 AD. In 41 AD, Thomas went to India, and the place of pilgrimage there is St. Thomas Mount on the outskirts of what is now called Chennai, but was for a long time called Madras. A Sanskrit word that describes that kind of a pilgrimage journey, the word is yajna. And the first Upanishad, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the great forced breath, spirit teaching, about 600 or 700 pages, was by Yajnavalka, who lived about 800 BC. The one who was able to make the initial long pilgrimage, and the icon for that was to be able to go by riding the horse of the wind, that one could see, he says, with the dimensional clarity that the sun was the eye of a horse and the cirrus clouds were the mane of the horse, and that if you were able in that way, on that dimension, to saddle up, then you could go a long way, for real. One of the great hopes for our time is that the yoga of civilization can be taught planet-wide all at once. It doesn't take anything except the sense of a yajna and or a yoga to continue it. And when that occurs, you will discover for yourself the carrier wave before 0 BC was 2000 BC, and there were a tuned pair of carriers for that wave. One of them we regularly cite as Abraham, going to a promised land that he had never been to, none of his people had ever been to, but was visionarily certain in the sense that by having faith to go, he would find. And it's interesting that the pair of that carrier wave of 2000 BC was Zarathustra. So that is particularly horribly dis-ironic that Israel and Iran should be on the brink of nuclear war in this carrier wave that is so fresh. And even more poignant that Zarathustra's great gathas were written in Kabul, in Afghanistan, though he was from Central Asia, around Samarkand. He fell in love and married the daughter of the king. The family name was Havolga, and he married the daughter of the king. I spent 10 years making a 21st century English poetic translation of the Gathas of Zarathustra. And here is just a couple of lines to give you the flavor of someone writing. He wrote it at age 75, so he wrote it about 1925 BC, which is actually almost mirroring the time, because one found that Abraham, also in his mid-70s, made his yajna in search of the Holy Land. So that the Holy Land and the Gathas are contemporaneous. They resonate together in a harmonic of civilization. You'll find a name in here, Asha. Very cultivated people from India will name a special daughter Asha. In Avestan, it means she who orders. She who orders things so that they're arranged, so that not only do they work, but they work beautifully and truthfully. So she's the fount of a ordered wisdom of life and of beauty. Who in himself is with me shall teach first. That one is worthy to be revered in respect for deeds of purity, which are Ahura's truth, which is your Asha of ordered speaking, seeking always my and your Vohuman. Vohuman is good mind. In contemporaneous Persian, the name given to special babies, male babies, is Bahman, but it's in Avestan, it's Vohuman. Good mind. Here is a follow-up to it. These are called hats, and they're arranged in lines. And it's interesting because there are four gathas in Zarathustra. The first has seven yajnas, the first three of 11 hats, and then they jump to 15, 14, 15. And you find that these seven yajnas stand for a cosmological shape of the all. And then you have a pair of four yajna gathas. And then you have the last, a single yajna, so that it's divided 7-4-4-1. And the one, that last yajna, has only three lines. The first seven have six lines. The first of the four yajnas has five lines. The second of the four has four lines, and then the final one has three lines, but it has 11 times two, it has 22 hots. So if you pair them, you get the 11 hot yasna. This is 51. The word in here is kshatra. Kshatra means the joy of the radiant real. Mazda is the radiance of the real. And then Asha, we know. Good kshatra, chosen gift, most glorified, delicate, effective worship at Asha's inner step. Inward deeds, Mazda's best place immersion. These are just a few lines, just to let you know that 4,000 years ago, when alphabetical language was first energizing a higher yoga, a longer yajna, that what came into play at that time has since, in retrospect, been called not the Dharma, but the High Dharma. Not simply being able to go back to primordial nature, the fount of spontaneous energy, which is the instantaneous generator of space, giving a space-time as a fabric that can have waves and particles that will be objectively, materially, real, but limited. A universe which has its membrane. It is almost impossible for someone who has not gone through the learning civilization to have the layered and interpenetrated qualities. But here's something that almost everyone can understand. 2,000 years ago, about 41 AD, as we've been talking about, not only did Thomas go to India and James go to Spain, but Saint Matthew went to Ethiopia. And so Thomas and Matthew shipped together out of Aqaba, out of Eilat, into the Red Sea, all the way down the Red Sea to the entrance of the Arabian Gulf, that Gulf of the Indian Ocean. And Thomas went to Aksum in Ethiopia, high in the mountains. Ethiopia is very wild. It's like northern Arizona. It's just wild, and almost no one was able to ever go down the origins of from the lake that begins that branch of the Nile that goes down. It's just a gorge, rapids, jungles, incredible, untamed persons, animals. And Thomas went on to India. The New Testament begins with Matthew, and in Matthew, the most poignant of all of the beginnings of Matthew's writings concern Joseph and his visionary, not dreams, but visions of the night, which gives him immediately to someone who would have been dimensionally literate at the time to understand that he was an inheritor of Daniel. That Daniel understood not only how to interpret dreams, but he could deepen it to interpret once-in-a-lifetime dreams, great archetypal dreams. And then he could energize it to a third level, that he could tell prophetically great visions of the future that would be coming. In Daniel's case, it was 490 years into the future. To confirm this took a special seal, a triple seal. And the seal occurs in the Gospel of Matthew at the beginning of the second chapter. It's about the visit of the three magi from Iran, who brought three gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh, which you can pack a lot of value in very small packages, which financed the Holy Family going to Egypt for as many years as it would take, so that the ancient Iranians financed the Jews to be free to live and to have their being. You begin to see what a catastrophic lie tissue is being engendered currently on the planet, and one needs to ask, as we will later, why? Who benefits from this? Who is doing this? And what can we do about it? Which is a lot. When Jesus was born at Bethlehem of Judah, in Judea, in the time of King Herod, magi came from the east to Jerusalem. Where, they ask, is the one who has been born as king of the Jews? For we have seen his star at its rising, and we have come to pay him homage. When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and the whole of Jerusalem with him. They brought the seal of the ability of Joseph to see visionarily what was now unfolding and where it might have its deep resonance. And he took that family to Alexandria, where the young Jesus, for the first 5 years of his life, grew up, which was a Judaism that was based on the Greek translation of the Torah. The Greek Bible is called the Septuagint, that translated by the 70. Actually, it was 72. They were given a special place on the island of Pharos by the great lighthouse. And Ptolemy II Philadelphus made sure that they were honored and cared for until they finished. And it's interesting because then the Pharos lighthouse became the symbolic beacon of the truthfulness of the translation into Greek of the, eventually, all of the, what we call the Old Testament now was translated into Greek over the next couple of generations. But to put the Torah in Greek meant that there was a huge population. Alexandria had about 2 million people. It was a megalopolis. It was the greatest city in the world. Rome had nothing on Alexandria. Two of the five districts of Alexandria were Jewish, so that their population there was well over 500,000 people, and quite extensively able not only to read and understand Hebrew, but to read and understand Greek as well, so that you got a double way of being able to read the written language. And because of that, the Alexandrian Jews are the first to master the allegorical method of looking through language into the visionary dimension, so that they could look with two different eyes, and their focus was farther than just the Hebrew or just the Greek. And so there was not a rabbinical Judaism or a Mosaic Judaism, but a Hellenistic Judaism of men and women who for generations, for centuries, were able to look with such a far-reaching focus that they were, as a community, able to understand that their inheritance now was like that lighthouse beacon. The pharos was 40 stories tall, 2,300 years ago. But when the Hellenistic Jews developed an old Pythagorean retreat center, they positioned it on a hill in such a way that they constructed another pharos lighthouse just 1/4 the size. Instead of being 40 stories tall, it was 10 stories tall. It's still there. And from that hill, one could not only see the little pharos by their community, but one could look up the coast about 25 miles and see the great beacon at the top of the 40-story real pharos, the original one. And right next to the little pharos was a huge temple of Osiris, the temple of the resurrection of Osiris. So that you had a community, a little lighthouse, a huge Osirian resurrection temple, all arranged in a community called Taposiris Magna, the great place of the reemergence by resurrection of Osiris, the great replica of the Tower of the Translation, the great place where the community of Jesus in Alexandria and Mary Magdalene, Philo of Alexandria, a number, were there for almost two generations of his lifetime. It's interesting to see that the qualities of especially the feminine wisdom had the biggest range following Thomas into India, and from India through Central Asia and into China especially, and on eventually into Japan. The figure of Mary Magdalene in India very early on became the Lady of High Wisdom, Lady Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom lady. And that Lady Prajnaparamita evolved by expansion into Kuan Yin. So that by the time it got into China, after several centuries, especially in the age of Tang Tai Tsung, one found Tang Tai Tsung, who was really somebody. He was if I can use a strange analogy here, he was like a Chinese John Wayne. Physically, he could ride the best, wildest horses, and he's the one that arranged that, look, we need to have outposts of hundreds and thousands of fresh horses every 20 miles or so, so that we can send an army on fresh horses across thousands and thousands of miles of my kingdom like that, and we can send it in waves. He commanded that a great stela be erected in his capital city of Chang'an. And next week I will bring a book printed in Japan that has a complete replica of it and was squelched because of the Second World War. And it was about the great cosmic religion of the Great Way. Not about the Mahayana, but about the source of the Mahayana, which by that time had several huge streams that were developing in Central Asia, in China, and eventually spreading all the way across into Europe. One of the waves was Manichaeism, the religion where Mani, a contemporary of Plotinus, put together the Mahayana, the original Zoroastrian, and the Christian, and tied them together in a triple bow, and Manichaeism for a long time, more than 1,000 years, was a much more powerful and populous religion than Christianity. A second development that came was that there were Christians in the 400s who refused to follow the doctrinal pecking away, making a symbolic tyranny of councils and orders and power mongering control. And they, under the Bishop Nestorius, were given a choice to either be killed or to go into exile into Central Asia. And so they went into Central Asia and flourished to the extent that it was a very formidable alternative to Buddhism, to Confucianism, to Manichaeism, to Taoism, so that you had again in the 600s AD in Chang'an a similar kind of a situation that was there 650 some years before in Alexandria. You had a population of men and women who were not just internationally alert, but that they were refined to such an extent that the pinnacle of Chinese civilization is in the Tang Dynasty, never eclipsed, never equaled again, including today. One of the most interesting women was a young concubine brought in to play in the harem of Tang Tai Tsung, and she was able to understand, because she understood men not in men's terms, but in a woman's terms. And she understood that all of this can be stylized in a different way, because all they need is to know who's in control. So she became, when she grew up, the first and only empress of Chinese Empire, Empress Wu. And under her, really strict control, she let this whole spectrum and range of possibilities mature, and so you began to have the first of the large array of places that were like caves, but they were interlocked caves, so that the model that she used was in ancient India called Ajanta. Hers in China was called Maigishan. Shan is mountain. Maigi is our best place. And it was the beginning of these tremendous developments, that there needed to be not just caravan stops or pilgrimage stops, destinations, but that there had to be places where the interweaving of all of the dimensions of civilization could advance themselves in a harmonic. And the direct inheritor in China of Maigishan was Dunhuang. And it's in Dunhuang that one finds a development of spiritual art that is on the level of early 20th century art. When I bring in some of the materials, you'll see it looks as if Matisse lived 1,000 years ago in China. More next week.